Hi, everyone. This is Mike Olson, Director of Development for Stand Up for Kids Orange County and the host of the Listen Up Stand Up for Kids podcast. On today's episode, we'll be speaking with Brian Haslip. Brian is currently the Director of Technology with Stand Up for Kids, and he's a former youth. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Mike.
All right. So first question for you is, when and where were you homeless?
I was homeless from 1995 until 2001 in San Diego, California. It was a rough period. The 90s were a weird time to be, well, it's always a weird time to be homeless, but the 90s were like a lot of change was going on, and it was, you know, it even affected us living on the streets. So,
yeah. So a 6-year time period of trying to figure out where you're going to sleep and eat and meet all of your basic needs.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, the eating and the sleeping part were especially difficult because people didn't really, they tried to avoid you as much as possible. They would look at you like you were trash. So it was, you know, setting out begging for change, spanging, as they call it. And then trying to find a place to sleep where you wouldn't get, you know, attacked by the adult homeless or wouldn't get rousted by the cops. You know, I don't want to say it was an adventure because that makes it sound fun, but it was a journey.
Yeah. And six years of that is a long time. You know, 1995, we're in 2020. So it's 25 years ago. So can you think of, you know, we've had a couple of guests on in the prior episodes that are talking about kind of what homelessness is like now. Can you think of things that would contrast with, you know, 1995 versus 2020 homelessness?
I think it's a lot easier now for, like, just technology-wise. Like, everyone has cell phones these days, even the homeless. And it's easier to, you know, to get in touch with other people, to get in touch with resources. It's a lot easier to, like, apply for jobs because you actually have a number they can call you on, which wasn't the case back in 1995.
Yeah, so did you have a cell phone?
I had a cell phone in 1999. That was the earliest I got one. And by then I wasn't sleeping on the streets every night. I was couch surfing, well, living with my girlfriend and her mom at the time. So, but it was still kind of a couch surfing situation because it was pretty tenuous.
And so you said San Diego?
Yeah, San Diego, California.
Okay. And were you where in San Diego? Was it downtown?
Yeah, I mostly stuck around downtown. There's a mall that's dead now, but it's called Horton Plaza. Mm-hmm. And that's where we had, between Broadway and Fourth Avenue, was called The Block. You know, there was a group of us, The Block kids. We all hung out, you know, we had each other's backs, kept each other safe, and basically lived at that mall for the most part. Like, most days you could find us there.
And why did you pick that location?
Because it's downtown. It's right near the Gaslamp Quarter, which is San Diego's big downtown, mm-hmm. you know, attraction. So there were lots of tourists. There was, you know, lots of foot traffic. So if we were spanging, we'd have a better shot at making a little bit of money from, you know, tourists and Navy folk. And, you know, it was just based on, one, the cops didn't really mess with us because it was public property. And two, there was a lot of foot traffic.
So 6 years of being homeless, no cell phone. So you're kind of like whatever's nearest to you, whatever, like whatever is super local is what you is the resources you have. You can't, whatever, you can't go find a job 20 miles away by picking up your phone.
Yeah, it was accessing resources as a youth in the 90s was very, very difficult because there weren't a lot of programs. There was like St. Vincent de Paul, but that's it's geared towards adults and it's a shelter. And a lot of kids, you know, even if they were able to get in, which most of us weren't because you've got to be 17, then you had to worry about being victimized by the other homeless, which happened a lot more often than I'd like to admit. But yeah, it was really difficult. And I think that's part of the reason that a lot of us were on the streets for so long was we didn't really have access to youth-oriented resources. It was everything was for adults.
Like you said, the security part of hanging out with adults is one thing. What else is it about youth focus? What else is a youth focus that I wouldn't otherwise think about?
Well, I mean, a lot of people look at homeless youth and they think, you know, go get a job, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get yourself off the street. And it's not that easy because if you're an adult, you've got someplace like St. Vincent de Paul or other shelters where you can get mail, where you can, you know, get phone calls, stuff like that. So, like, I didn't have an ID and I didn't have anywhere to get mail to get an ID. So you can't get a job without an ID, can't, you know, it's a cycle. Like it was a cycle of not being able to get a job because I couldn't get the documents because I didn't have a place to get mail. You know, it was an endless cycle.
A lot of roadblocks that would seem trivial to most people now, but for you and your situation, like those are real issues that literally prevented improvement of your situation.
Yeah, it was that way for all of us. You know, it was like, I don't think anyone that I knew had a cell phone until like 1998. So it was hard. It was just struggling every day to try and figure out what to do to make things better for yourself. And then, you know, just having one, like you said, roadblock in front of another put up.
And then probably at some point you get a little hopeless and you just kind of say to hell with it.
Yeah, I was definitely depressed the majority of the time. Tried to kill myself more times than I can count. Just because it was hopeless. Like I didn't see any kind of light at the end of the tunnel. I started doing drugs to cope with the not being able to get food. You know, so it was just at one point I just saw myself as a useless junkie and didn't think that I was didn't want to survive, honestly, and certainly didn't see any kind of light at the end of the tunnel.
And it sounds like the things that, like I said, the things that you're running into to me, not knowing homelessness, seems like, oh, well, just go do the thing and get the ID and like get over that hump and then get over that hump. And it, so if you had resources, if you had someone to help you or navigate through some kind of bureaucratic things, that might have really had a big impact early on for you.
Oh, absolutely. I think I got off the streets when I was 21. And I think that if I'd had someone to help and, you know, someplace to get mail, someone to help me with all of the stuff, because getting an ID isn't as easy as just going down to the DMV. You got to have, you know, an address. You've got to have the cash for it. You've got to, you know, it's not just go down and get one. And I think if somebody had been there at the start, to help me do all that and, you know, give me a place to not necessarily crash at, but get mail at, then I think I probably could have gotten off the streets a lot sooner.
You weren't on the street because you wanted to be there. You ended up there because of circumstances, and you were actively trying to get yourself off of there, but just couldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, at first, going to the streets is terrifying. Especially for me, I grew up in small town Arkansas, you know, and so hitting the streets in a major metro area like San Diego, I didn't know what to expect. I was terrified, like I said. I got pretty lucky in that the group of kids that I would hang with found me really, really quickly and brought me into their group. The majority of homeless youth don't want to be on the streets. They're not there because they want to be. They're not there because they're having a good time and partying and whatnot. They're there because something happened that led to them finding themselves on the streets. And it's just, once you're there, 15 years old, 16 years old, it's just, like we've said, like we've talked about, it's incredibly hard to do anything to start getting yourself off the streets. I mean, it's easier now, clearly, mostly, like I said, because of technology, but it's just, yeah, back then it was, you got stuck really quickly.
And what is having a group of friends do for you?
Well, it's one, just, you know, it helps you stay sane. Plus you're protected, you know, it's, you're all fighting against the same thing. And so you're kind of battle buddies in a way, you know, it's, you're just, you have each other's backs. You know, if I got handed $15 and went to McDonald's, all my friends were getting McDonald's too. You know, it was just, that's the way it was. We were like a, not like a commune, but like a family, you know?
Yeah. Was it hard to build trust with those people?
You would think so, but not really. Like, I think a lot of it for me was how quickly they brought me in. You know, there were rules. Like, there was a area that a lot of us squatted at that was under a bridge. And we had an unofficial leader named Bob. And one of the rules was, you know, no meth, no heroin, nothing like that at the camp. And so it was kind of like a little hierarchy. And so trust was built pretty quickly because, you know, it's when you're nice to somebody and they're nice to you and you get to know each other, you know, and you can just feel if somebody's gonna have your back. You can feel if you can trust somebody. And we all did. Like, there were, I mean, shady people popped in and out now and then, but for the core group, you know, we all trusted each other with our lives, essentially.
How big was your group?
The core group was about 12, 15 people. It wasn't a huge group. It was just, you know, because if you get too many people, you're kind of blowing up your spot, you know, too many people going in and out, somebody's going to notice. So it stayed pretty small, generally, but it was a solid core. You know, everybody knew each other, everybody trusted each other, everybody looked out for each other.
So you had a government, kind of a loose government with laws and rules and a system,
kind of.
A system, I guess, yeah. You could say.
Yeah, we definitely had a system there. And that's how you survive. You know, you have to have rules. Can't just be like anarchy. You can't have people you know, in one tent doing heroin, because that can lead to shady behavior. You know, you don't want those people coming over, taking your stuff, pawning it, whatever. So yeah, there was general rules that we abided by just to keep the group safe as a whole.
And was Bob like, so if you have rules, you need to have enforcement. So is Bob the enforcement?
There were a lot of people in that group that could throw hands. Bob was probably number one. Like he was a smaller guy, but he had hands.
And how old are the people in the group? What is the age range?
We were all generally about the same age. I think it was probably like, I think our youngest was a little girl. She was 9. And the oldest was like 16.
Wow. How old is Bob?
I want to say Bob's a couple of years younger than me. So I want to say he was like 13, 14 at the time.
Okay, so what is, can you give me a circumstance where enforcement or discipline needed to happen?
Okay, so one time, one of the guys brought in a friend who none of the rest of us knew. And that friend ended up stealing one of our friend's radio, which, you know, music on the streets was something, helped pass the time. So radio is pretty important. So a couple of days later, we were down on the block and the kid came walking by and Bob just popped up immediately and socked him in the mouth. I'm assuming the kid learned his lesson because we never saw him again. But we didn't get the radio back either. So it was just, you know, but that was enforcement.
How do you come across the 9-year-old girl? What does that look like?
Well, she was living on the streets with her mom and her sister. Although her sister was often in family houses, like being shuffled around between family members. But she was taken under the group for protection, because at 9 years old, you shouldn't be on the streets, even with your mom. And her mom kind of had some drug issues. So we felt like, you know, the more people looking out for her, the better.
So did she sleep where you guys slept, or did she sleep with her mom, or how did that
work? No, she generally spent evenings and nights with her mom. Although she did spend a couple of nights now and then in the camp.
And were siblings and parents typically involved on some level with the crew?
No. Generally, there were some siblings, but generally it was the parents weren't around at all.
How long were you with that group of people?
I still know most of them to this day. We were all part of the same group up until I ended up getting off the streets. And I mean, we're still like, we've got Facebook groups called the Block Kids, you know, it's, you know, we keep in touch and I see quite a few of them like not now because of the pandemic, but before we were all staying home, I saw most of them quite often. The majority of them are off the streets and clean and, you know, doing well for themselves.
That's great. So if I know I haven't been to San Diego I haven't been downtown for maybe a year, but I know homelessness is still a major issue in San Diego, as it is in many parts of the country. Do you think there's a group of Block Kids that exist in San Diego like what you were a part of now?
Not in the same way. Ever since, and this is a long time ago, but ever since Petco Park, home of the Padres, went up, there's been a real push by downtown business owners and the cops and everything to kind of push the homeless people off to other areas of the city. When I go downtown, I do see kids now and then, generally hanging out in the park in front of the mall. But it doesn't seem to be a group like we had.
It's a really young group.
Yeah, which is why we, banded together. It's easier to stay safe when you're surrounded by people whose interests are tied to yours.
Wow. Okay, so you mentioned, I think you said Arkansas?
Yeah.
Yeah, being from Arkansas. So can you tell me just a little bit about growing up and how you got from Arkansas to San Diego, and how did you end up homeless?
Well, growing up was, I never really fit in there, because it's a town called Dover. It's at the time, I think they had 1,300 people there, maybe less than that. And it's very redneck, which I never was. So I grew my hair out, anytime something went wrong in town, they'd come to me because, long-haired heavy metal kid. And it was just boring. I mean, there's nothing to do in a town that small. So one night, me and a friend and my girlfriend were all just hanging out at my dad's house, and we decided to go up to Fort Smith. None of us had a car. Fort Smith is on the border of Arkansas and Oklahoma. So we figured we'd go up there, and then we'd pop over into Oklahoma, see what trouble we could get into, and then go home, There was something to do besides, hang out in the Walmart parking lot of this town next door. So we did that. And once we got over in Oklahoma, we're standing right next to Interstate 40, which runs, from East Coast to West Coast. And somebody, probably me, decided or asked whether we thought we could make it to California if we tried. 3 days later, we're in California, get picked up by the cops in Barstow, which is...
Question for you. How did you get... What's your transportation?
Oh, we were hitchhiking.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is how we got picked up in Barstow. We actually got picked up before that, but the cop just gave us a ride down the freeway. So we get to Barstow. They get sent home. I yelled at my dad until he told the cops I could stay. Cause I was trying to convince them I was 18. He was telling them that I wasn't, which I wasn't. But eventually, the cops let me walk out the front of the police station. Got stuck in Barstow for 3 days, which is not something I'd recommend. Barstow, nice town, but you've seen most of it after a day. So then I 3 days later, I'm in San Diego. My mom lived here at the time. She didn't know I was coming, so that was quite the surprise for her. So I lived with her for a couple of months, and then it turned out she had a roommate who liked young boys. So rather than deal with that, I just, headed to the streets. And that's, I think, you'll find maybe not similar stories to mine, but for how I ended up on the streets, but I think a lot of times you'll find events like the one that caused me to go to the street to be the reason that a lot of people do.
Yeah, and the story you describe of getting to California sounds like I'm a bored teenager who does something stupid, but I'm gonna guess there's more to that story with your family in Arkansas or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, my family was good. My dad was awesome. He was a good guy. I put him through way too much trauma and just ridiculousness. But there was a well-known guy in our town who built houses, and took an interest in me, which at first I didn't, you know, I was young, naive, didn't realize where this was going to end up. Went out riding four-wheelers all the time, you know, just having a good time, hanging out with, he knew the family of my crush really well. So we hung out over there a lot. And then eventually that turned into, you know, he's a child molester. So that's kind of what sent me down the whole depression path in the first place. I didn't start trying to kill myself until later, but that's kind of what kicked everything in motion. And then seeing the courts not really do anything about it. They gave him a slap on the wrist and he was back out on the streets. And the last time I saw him, he was sitting outside one of the houses he was working on with two kids in the front yard. So it was just, you know, it gave me a real good dose of reality at an age where I should have still not had to deal with that much reality. So yeah, that's part of what led me to just, you know, eventually just leave.
How old were you when you ended up in Barstow?
I was 15.
But yeah,
all this other stuff happened between 13 and 14. So it went on for a little while. It's hard to explain why I let it keep happening, because I don't really know myself. And I think that's, you know, it's hard to explain unless you've lived through it, which fortunately most people haven't.
Mm-hmm. So going to California is escaping from that BS.
That was funny. Yeah. Yeah. It was just, I knew that I was never, or I felt like I was never going to have a fair life in Dover, because everyone already assumed that I was, you know, the bad kid, and cops clearly didn't care enough to do anything about the stuff that was going on. The courts didn't care. So, I mean, what was the point of me sticking around?
Yeah, but so your dad would be the one thing I would wonder about. So you said you have a good relationship with him, and that wasn't enough of a good thing to help. I don't know how to say it.
Well, he didn't really know until it all came out. You know, I got caught skipping school one day, and I was in the principal's office, and it just, you know, it all came out to the principal. And my dad, there was some enforcement. My dad did a lot more than the cops or the courts did. Spent a couple of days in jail over it, which, you know, good for him.
Mm-hmm.
I would name if anybody touched my kids. Mm-hmm. So,
me too.
My dad, he did what he felt was right, and I agree with him. He stood up for me, something like I said that the cops and the courts didn't do. So yeah, I mean, I regret leaving the way I did, especially because I didn't get to see more of my dad in the years before he passed. But I can't say I'd ever want to undo it, because coming to San Diego ended up with me having my own kids. So, you know, like Frankie says, regrets, I've got a few.
Wow. Okay, so let's go back to, I think, 2001. Is that so? Let's go back to, all right, I'm on the streets. I've got my group. I'm trying to get off the streets. How do you finally do it?
Well, by 2001, okay, let me backtrack a little bit. A few years earlier, there was a little coffee shop downtown, a little Gothic coffee shop called Old Vienna. And it was where all the goth kids hung out, you know, Navy folks, whatever. And that's where I would go hang out every night, because, you know, I was a little goth kid. And so one day I'm sitting down there and sitting outside the place, because I'd been kicked out for no reason, probably because I was homeless and never bought anything. But so I'm sitting there outside the coffee shop and I see these people in purple walking up to me. And my first thought was, what do these people want? Because, you know, somebody approaches you when you're living on the streets, generally they want something from you. They don't want to help you. But the first question that they asked me was how long it had been since I'd talked to my parents, and then they handed me a cell phone. And that was my introduction to Stand Up for Kids. They kept coming back, and eventually, you know, I said trust was easy for me to build up with the other kids. It took a lot longer for me to build up that trust with the purple people, Standing for Kids. Because one, my experiences in the past, and two, just, you know, it's, streets are a dangerous place and you've got to watch out. You always expect ulterior motives. Mm-hmm. But they kept coming back week after week, bring me food and clothes and, you know, hygiene products, whatever I needed. Then they opened up a center, an outreach center, which was, you know, awesome, because even if I didn't eat anything all day, I could go there and, you know, at least eat once a day. Plus it was a place to go where, you know, I could lay down for a couple hours and not have to worry about my stuff getting stolen or somebody messing with me, or, you know, it was kind of a safe space. I know people use that as kind of a awkward term these days, but it really was. It was a place where I could go and be safe, and, you know, it was awesome. So it was through working with Stand Up that, you know, all of a sudden got that outreach center. I've got food on a regular basis. I've got a place where I can get mail. I've got a place where I can get phone calls. I've got a place where I can take a shower. So it was working with them. And then also, you know, by then I was living with my girlfriend. So it was easier for me to, I didn't want to use her address or her phone number, because I was already, you know, kind of a, not necessarily uninvited guest, but I felt like I was already, you know, just taking advantage of their kindness. So I was able to get an ID. Stand Up paid for that. And they paid for me to get my guard card, which you have to have in California to work security. So then I was able to get a job with Elite Security and started making my own money for the first time really ever. And that helped a lot, until me and my girlfriend broke up, and then I was back out on the streets and, you know, lost my job because I, you know, didn't really have a way to get there anymore. So that's when I met the mom of my children. And so we were out there. I want to say we dated a little over a year. Well, a little over a year before she got pregnant. So this is like 2000, end of 2001. So she got pregnant in 2001, late 2001. And we went to the center and talked to some of the counselors there about, well, one, we were both tweakers. We were both using meth, which was something that, you know, she got pregnant, we wanted to stop doing. So we went there and we asked them, hey, do you think you can help us out with Greyhound tickets to her dad's place in Texas? And they did. They bought them. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, we were on our way to a even smaller town than I grew up in Texas, a little place called Rotan. We get there, you know, got sober because there's nowhere in that little town, nobody's selling meth. It wasn't the epidemic that it is today. Yeah, so we got there and I got a job working at a cotton gin, which I would not recommend. That's awful. And then got a job working on a road crew, putting up street signs. My son was born in April of 2002. And, you know, the only time I've spent on the streets since is when I've been doing 24 hours on the streets for Stand Up For Kids. Haven't touched meth since or any other hard drugs. So it was really, I don't want to say it was one specific thing. I mean, it kind of was. It was the bus tickets that got me off the streets, but it was also like the years of support before that. You know, it's a lot easier to get through the day knowing that you're going to eat at least once than it is if you have no idea when you're going to eat next. So I think that's what a lot of people I think don't understand is you can tell someone to get off the streets, but unless they've got a support system, it's easy to fall right back to it. You know, it's you got to have that parachute or that safety net.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not rocket science either, I guess, is maybe a takeaway. You need a meal, you need access to an ID, you ultimately need to get a job so that you have money to support yourself. But it, like you said, a safety net.
I think a lot of people take for granted that they don't think about that. You know, a lot of people have their family they can fall back on, or, you know, they have, you know, their wives or their husbands but kids on the streets don't really, a lot of times they don't have that. You know, they've run away from bad situations, or their parents have disowned them for coming out, or, you know, whatever. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't ever think about is, you know, these kids, even once you get them off the streets, they're one missed paycheck from being back on.
I think a lot of people live like that. Kids, adults, everybody, they're one hospital bill or one fight or one incident away from being in a really rough spot.
Yeah.
So having a resource to go to when that happens is huge. If you can be there when that happens, you can help them through it for potentially a really short period of time at a person's low point, and then send them back on their way to a stable situation. But if you let that situation fester and there is no safety net, then you can fall into long-term issues.
Yep, absolutely.
So where are you now? What's life like for you, for Brian in 2020?
Crazy, like everybody's life in 2020. As you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a director of training and information technology for Stand Up for Kids, which really, like, I've kind of been working on and off for Stand Up for Kids since a year after they helped me get off the streets, like off and on as a trainer, independent contractor, you know, and now a full-time employee. I'm still in San Diego for now. We'll see what the future has, but right now I'm in America's finest city, working for Stand Up, doing assistant managing for my apartment complex. You know, it's a pretty good life. Hectic, crazy, but pretty good.
And you have a 17 or 18 year old, is my math right?
I have an 18-year-old and a 17-year-old. That just makes me feel super old. So my son was born in 2002. My daughter was born the next year in Tacoma when I was working for Stand Up for Kids. It's crazy having adult kids. After, you know, sometimes I still feel like a teenager, so it's just weird. Awesome, but it's weird.
Do they know kind of the life you've had?
They know bits and pieces. They know that me and their mom lived on the streets, and we've kind of used that to teach them, you know, and try to move them, you know, away from things like drugs and alcohol. And it's worked. They're never going to know all the details because there's just, one, a lot that I can't remember, and two, a lot that they don't need to hear. But they know the basics. Yeah. And like I said, it's been a good teachable moment for them.
And I know I butchered your title at the beginning, but it is a mouthful.
Yeah.
But do you, and I know that's mostly disconnected from being directly working with youth. And I'm in a similar role. But does, you know, obviously your path and now what you're doing are, whatever, have a lot of parallels. How do you feel about that?
I like being able to give back. You know, I like being able to help the organization that helped me survive to, you know, get to better places. I do miss some of that hands-on working with the kids. And, you know, if we ever get back to in-person trainings, if this pandemic ever ends, then, you know, maybe I can get back to doing that a bit. But right now, you know, it's nice to be able to help the program that helped me in, you know, any way I can.
One more question for you. Right. if you could tell the listeners who are, who just heard our discussion here, one additional thing about youth homelessness that they don't already know, or if you had kind of just a closing thought, what would you say?
I think a lot of people have an idea in their head of what youth homelessness is like. And I think for most people, it's completely off base. Like, one thing about being a youth on the streets is monotony. Like, there are long stretches of nothing happening. And that's why a lot of kids fall into drug and alcohol use, is because you're just sitting there doing nothing for hours and hours and hours each day. And it's not that these kids want to be junkies. I didn't. But, you know, you start using them and you're like, oh, well, this adds some, you know, this adds some spice to my day. And then next thing you know, you've been using for 5 years and having trouble getting off it. And I think people just don't think enough about what kind of situation these kids are in and the reason that they do some of the things they do. Because it's easy to say, well, yeah, the kid's out there on the streets because they want to do drugs, or that kid's out on the streets because they didn't want to listen to their parents and they want to party all the time. For me and most of the kids I was on the streets with, the drugs came after. And it was because we're just out there, you know, dying on the streets and dying slowly. And so it's just, you know, maybe in some messed up way for me, it was trying to self-destruct faster. But for a lot of kids, it's just boredom. And then that leads to drug use, and that leads to making the situation even worse.
You have an upper?
All right. Well, here's an upper. 99% of the kids I was on the streets with are off the streets now. They're sober. They're doing great. I still talk to them. It's as bad as the streets can be, you can find good parts in them. And I think that's, you know, making 12 to 15 lifelong friends in the middle of a bad situation is something I never expected, but something I'm very, very glad I did.
That's good. Awesome. Well, thank you, Brian. It's been illuminating. I appreciate the discussion. I appreciate you joining us and giving your time today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening today to Listen Up, the Stand Up for Kids podcast. A big thank you to Gabby Villarreal and Billy Wynn for their production and editing support. Find us on YouTube, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support Stand Up for Kids, please share this podcast with family, friends, and colleagues. Also, check out our website at standupforkids.org/Orange County, and you can email me directly at michaelo@standupforkids.org to learn more. Please also consider a donation to help getting kids off the streets. 92 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to supporting these kids. I'm your host, Michael Olson, Director of Development at Stand Up for Kids, Orange County. Thanks for listening and have a great day.